I think we'll get started right now, and others may join us later. Part of the reason I put this graphic of Martin Luther with the saying, I don't always nail things to church doors, but when I do, it starts a movement for those who are listening to this. But for those of you coming late, so you at least know what we're kind of focusing on. I'm not going to give a whole lecture of Luther and Luther's theology, etc. I'm going to be focusing in a particular way and particular project I've been a part of. My name is Karen Blomquist, and I actually was the first time in Holden Village in 1970 in the work staff, and over the past 40 years I've been on the teaching staff at different points in time, so it's good to be back here at Holden as you open up. And I think it's significant that Holden is reopening to its regular programming the year of 2017, in other words, the 500th anniversary of when this character nailed, the legend anyway, he nailed the theses to the church door. There's dispute as to whether he actually did that there or not, but that's neither here nor there. So the topic of this, and to say a little bit word about myself, I was one of the first women ordained in the Lutheran Church in 1974, and I've been a parish pastor and then a seminary professor at LSTC in Chicago, at Wartburg Seminary in Philadelphia, and most recently was a dean at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. And I currently reside in a co-housing community, a very interesting community that's coming into being in Oakland, California. I'm mentioning these, so if you want to pick up on any of these other things in conversations with me, you know, you're more than welcome to. I left LSTC as the ELCA was coming into being and was directing the department to which the social statements of the church were developed. So I was in that capacity for a while. And then in 99, went to Geneva, Switzerland, with my late husband, and my son was actually here with me, and directed the theological work of the Lutheran World Federation. So among other things, I think it's significant, and we heard this in the prayers during the Eucharist Sunday night, that this is the month when the Lutheran World Federation Assembly is actually meeting in Namibia, which actually is one of the most Lutheran countries in the world, and not necessarily Germany or even Scandinavia these days, but I think that says something about the spread of Lutheranism sent in the past 500 years. But in many ways, the event that became kind of one of these aha experiences for me was about 2 months after I came to the LWF staff, is when the signing of the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification took place in Augsburg, Germany, which was rather, you know, a historic kind of moment. And I still remember the day before this, sitting in the town hall of Augsburg, which is very ornate, you know, gold leaf all over the place. And the Lord Mayor, that's what he's called, the Lord Mayor said, "What is going to happen tomorrow is significant in European history because in many ways this is really bringing to a climatic end 500 years of how Germany and much of the rest of Europe was divided up after the event of 500 years ago began." And which, you know, it was kind of stunning as an American to sit there and to hear that, because certainly in this country, Lutherans have not had a strong shaping influence in terms of what's the history and the politics that's occurred here. Until recently, there weren't even many Lutherans in Congress, for example. And yet, you know, in Germany especially, you know, it was, well, this prince, you know, you know, this part of Georgia became Protestant and this became Catholic, and some of you know that history fairly well, and I don't want to go into it right now. But in many ways, the Lord Mayor of Augsburg was seeing that what this bringing together of the Roman Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church in the signing of the Joint Declaration, even though they're still apart in some ways, was really historically significant. And the project I'm going to be focusing on a little bit today is called Radicalizing Reformation. And by radicalizing, we came up with that name to say, how do we get to the core of what the Reformation was about? So it isn't a matter of just being, you know, politically radical or whatever, although quite frankly, some of the, if you look at some of what is I'm going to be sharing, it does tend to move a bit in that direction. But radicalizing really is getting to the core of how, in the midst of the crisis that Luther was facing in that day, it was going back to the Bible and understanding and reading again Scripture in light of the contemporary realities. And so that's kind of the subtitle of the Radicalizing Reformation kind of project. I'll say a little bit more about some of the publications that have come of that in just a minute. This whole project, which was about 5 years, ended with our gathering in Wittenberg, Germany in January of this year, in a sense the kickoff of the Luther year. And even before then, I was well aware of the fact that in Germany, this is really a big event. I mean, major publications and books have been coming out over the last year or two, and you know, all kinds of events. I mean, you know, probably in ways that would upstage even the event in Minneapolis, or the art, the exhibit. You know, lots of tours. In fact,
I think it's the cable on the side has to be pushed in.
Okay.
This one. That one.
Yeah. Okay.
Well. Yeah.
Yeah, it's coming back. But in many ways, in that part of Germany, it is filled with kitsch of various kinds. You know, little bottles of special kinds of liqueur that have Luther's name on it, and you know, all of the items you can buy. In fact, earlier this month, or a month ago, I was one of the presenters at a major event on Bonhoeffer in New York City, and the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, or the EKD, the Protestant Church in Germany, which includes Lutherans, Reformed, and United Church folks, he said, you know, the Playmobil character that kids play with, they have developed, for example, a Luther, a modern Luther. And Playmobil company has discovered this is the all-time bestseller.
Oh, really? Every Lutheran needs one.
That's right. And that's just one example. I mean, one could do countless other examples. And so it has really become a big event in German society. In fact, some of my German friends who live there say, we are so tired of this. We've been hearing about it for some years. So, in other words, it's really plastered all over the place, and with different kinds of events and food and goods, etc. Being involved in this project, I, as well as others, have been trying to get something going, especially here on the West Coast, where, as I said earlier, before we got started, you know, where Lutherans are definitely a small minority. And again, the idea here, even in Germany, is not so much, are you Lutheran, but how did he set some things forth that whether people are Lutheran or not, they've been affected by. But what is the name that people in this country resonate with instead when they hear Martin Luther? Some of your
Martin Luther King.
Yeah, Martin Luther King.
Junior.
And so, again and again, I think especially for the younger generation, that is a name that comes to the fore much more readily than Martin Luther. And about a month ago, Thursday, I think it was, on April 4th was the 50th anniversary of King's rather famous speech in Riverside Church in New York, where he opposed the war and some of the economic issues and et cetera. Quite frankly, it was a year before he was actually assassinated, and some even say, well, he became more radical in challenging some of the structural injustice. You know, in other words, he didn't just stay within civil rights. And anyway, at the church that I was pastor of in the late 70s, which is pastored by an African-American pastor right now, an event took place called From Reformation to Revolution. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because, and I didn't have anything to do with this, although I was there, even though some of us were Lutheran, I would say the vast, you know, it was majority African-Americans, including people who had marched with King and a Jewish rabbi, and, you know, various other people were a part of this event. So in many ways, seeing that it probably isn't by accident that this connection is made, because from at least what I've heard is Martin Luther King Jr.'s father very intentionally took the name Martin Luther. He changed his name. You know, obviously King is there too. So there was a connection, even though he was Baptist or whatever. So I'm saying that because I think the, you know, what Luther set forth has resonances around the world, including with people that we might not normally associate with, for example, Luther or Martin Luther. One of the projects that I think has been very helpful, and I'll mention this because I think some of the people here in the Northwest have helped make that happen, a book called The Forgotten Luther. Have any of you heard of that book? Or yeah. And Samuel Torvin at PLU and others were a part of this. Paul Wee, who has recently moved to Lacey, he and others organized a major event in D.C. about a year and a half ago, and discovered that for many from Lutheran churches, even reading what or hearing what Luther said about some of the economic issues of his day was something they were not familiar with. So to some degree, The Forgotten Luther, and I hope the bookstore here will get some copies of it. I think it's through Fortress, but I'm not sure. Anyway, The Forgotten Luther has a number of articles, some of whom have been a part also of this project. I think those are some of the significant events that have happened. But what I would like to do is share with you some portions from a book I published last year. Actually, I have some copies of this book available half price for me. This will be more of the focus, the seeing, remembering, connecting it, subversive practices of being church will be more of the focus of next week. But if any of you want to get a copy or two, you can this week. But let me share with you some of the things I've tried to pull together here. Luther viewed early capitalism as beginning to function as a domination structure. Its practices were devouring the poor, and the world was becoming one big whorehouse where the big thieves hang the little thieves. Quote, according to Luther, that part was a quote, the world was becoming one big whorehouse. In other words, what I'm going to share with you are some passages here which would probably, if pastors or others in this country said the same things, they would be, you know, driven out rather quickly. But But of course, Luther's sometimes use rather insinuate, you know, lambastic language. According to Luther, the power of trading companies manipulated people's minds and veiled the truth, so that making money through charging high interest was seen as good. Quote, so sweet is the poison of the paradise apple that they want to make mammon their god and raise themselves through his power to become gods over the poor, lost, and miserable people, unquote. Users and idolaters serve mammon. They lack credibility and cannot have or receive the forgiveness of sins, nor the grace of God, nor the communion of saints. You know, Luther was pretty radical here. In other words, they should be excommunicated. They should even be thrown out of the church. And in his explanation of the seventh commandment, Luther wrote that stealing is taking advantage of someone. Wherever business is transacted and money is exchanged for good or service. Thieves sit in their chairs and are known as great lords and honorable, upstanding citizens, while they rob and steal under the cloak of what is legal. Luther accused the Catholic Church in his day of protecting such thieves. Spiritual governance was geared toward what would make money, especially, for example, through the selling of indulgences. As reflected in a number of his writings, Luther clearly sensed the political economic alliance, the interlocking powers of domination that were developing between the Catholic Church in his day and the reigning government, for example, of Charles V. And the emerging large economic powers, and especially he lashed out against the Fuggers. It's two G's, but when you say two G's, it sounds like a different word. So I won't say it. The problem was not only how greedy individuals were using money, but the structural social damage inherent in the idolatry of the law of the market, which was impersonal and autonomous. The rising world economy was already beginning to suck up urban and local economies in his time, and with increasing gaps between the rich and the poor. This can destroy the ethos of the community. And this is why Luther considered this systematic matter to be a matter of faith and not just of ethics. So there's been a number of writings, including some that have come through in the various publications of the Radicalizing Reformation Project. And this first paragraph especially focuses on how the call to repentance really was also a repentance of what is going on in society. And these are just the titles of some of the books that have come out. There isn't time necessarily for you to read all this, but volume one on liberation toward justice, Volume 2, Liberation from Mammon. Volume 3, Politics and Economy of Liberation. Volume 4, Liberation from Violence for Living in Peace. And Volume 5, Church Liberated for Resistance and Transformation. I've listed here also Volume 6. Volume 5 and 6 I edited, but 6 was our attempt to bring together a lot of the essay. Most of these books are a combination of German and English, depending on who had written the articles. But volume 6 is where all of the volumes written, all of the articles written in English are put together. This was made possible through a German publisher, but I think you can find it still available through Amazon. So that's why I have the title there at the end. Let me just say a few more things, and then I want to hear some of your reactions to this. This is from the beginning of what we put together as 94 theses. We did not want upstage Luther. So that's why we carefully refrained and only had 94 theses. And they go on and on. In fact, there is also a congregational study guide that is a way of condensing the theses. They get rather long. I mean, they're, at least in the initial stage of this, it was heavily Germanic, and as I can say this because I'm half German, you know, Germans like to go on and on and on and on, you know, and say things sometimes with lots of words. And so I've developed a congregational study guide, and there are some, you can get that through me. I'll put my email on there, or those of you who don't have access to email, especially here at Holden, you might want to take one of those or for your congregation. But this particular portion from the preface to the theses, I think, is especially helpful. Let me read it. The rapid destruction of human and non-human life in a world ruled by the totalitarian dictatorship of money and greed requires a radical reorientation toward the biblical message, which also is what marked the beginning of the Reformation. The dominant economic system and its imperial structures and policies have put the earth, human communities, and the future of our children up for sale. Thus, in relation to many facets of today's crisis, there is a call for repentance and conversion toward a more just society. Now, this was put together in 2015. So some of what we in the U.S. have been through in the last year is not necessarily even reflected here. But tomorrow, by the way, I'm getting a bit into how Luther confronted the dominating powers of his day today, of his day. I'm doing that today and tomorrow a little bit. How do we deal with theologically? How do we respond to the situation we're facing? You know, so it'll be a kind of continuation of this. But I wanted to also read the last part of, if I can find where it is, the last part of this, which I think is especially this continues after the quote that's on the screen. Our churches and individual Christians have often become complacent and complicit with the established status quo and have lost their critical prophetic power to protest, resist, and change what is occurring. God's justification by grace has been detached from social justice and thus serves as a useless salt. Because the Reformation legacy has gone astray, we must at the same time return to some of Luther's thought and legacy, as well as standing decidedly against other things he said and did, if this is to become a kairotic time of transformation today. 2 days from now, we'll be looking at that because this is not, at least my intent is not just to say, oh, rah, rah, Luther, let's embrace everything Luther said and did. Certainly the Peasants' War was, you know, he flipped a bit on that. At first he was wanting to support the peasants, but then not. And certainly some of his strongly anti-Jewish and anti-Turk kinds of statements are something that we really, you know, fortunately, Lutherans have denounced a lot of that. And of course, the way in which that was drawn on by, for example, in the 30s in Germany is a little bit disturbing when the, quote, German Christians, not the confessing Christians, but the other side, said, oh yeah, Luther said such and such, and they saw Hitler as the new Luther. So in other words, there's some stuff that in Luther's legacy that had been attached to him that I think we really need to come to grips with, including the way he read Paul, which we'll be looking at that a bit more, because it's been somewhat problematic the way in which he did set up things that lead to a lot of the polarization we're dealing with today. But that's neither here nor there. Let's just pause, and if there's any reactions to what I've been saying thus far, or questions, or... It's that time of the day, huh?
So the word radicalizing, does that just mean taking it way to another end, bringing it back to the center? I mean, is there?
It's really getting at the heart of the repentance that Luther was calling for. Was not just a matter of, you know, a spiritual kind of thing, but dealing with the systemic kinds of issues in society. I was looking, for example, at Luther's the Luther works in the library here, and on trade and usury, I mean, he goes on for 70 pages about how business should conduct its affairs. And, you know, I mean, a lot of times we ignore the fact that in many of Luther's writings, we're dealing with the social conditions of his time, you know, on schools, on, you know, certainly on marriage, but on lots of other kinds of things. Let me just share with you a little bit more along this line so you can get at what I'm getting at here. So it really is a matter of going to the heart of that. Luther broke open the system of domination in his day by proposing a much different kind of relationship with God. He responded both to people's fears connected with their social longings, their desires, and he touched the ecclesial nerve center of his day. In other words, its financial support and its divine legitimacy. Luther wanted to find a crack in the reigning consensus of the church, economy, and politics, because that's how he, you know, those three realms are that he especially focused on. He wanted to find a crack by cracking the surface. The justice of God, as we read up in Scripture, breaks in and fragments the systems of this world. The theology of the cross frees theology from captivity to the dominant modes of rationality that are operating. So justification by grace, which in many ways has been seen, and I think rightly, as the core of what the Reformation was about, overcomes in principle and in practice the division between the religious and the secular aspects of life, at least as those were divided up in the medieval world. God's justification causes us to see ourselves, our neighbor and our world differently. Not based on inherent acceptability or net worth, but in ways that are countercultural, even subversive of what are the reigning ideologies. For example, you can make yourself if only you try hard enough, and those that succeed are the ones who matter. We never hear that, right? Justification, in contrast to that, is prophetic speech from the heart of the divine pathos, a call to remembrance that is deeper than morality or civility. It is transcendent beyond any promise of the reigning structural or ideological bondage. And so a pervasive thread and intent in Luther's theology was to make this breakthrough practical, experiential, to really speak to common, ordinary folks, which is why he wrote, for example, what? The Small Catechism, right? So that, and in a patriarchal society, it was the fathers, that they could teach the essentials of the Christian faith to their family. But I think, you know, to me, Luther was extraordinary in the way he used, you know, certainly the invention of the printing press and the churning out of all kinds of tracts or pamphlets. Today, you know, he'd be probably using the internet and all of the social media kinds of things. So how do we, you know, how do we, especially in a society where many people's notion of what it means to be Christian has been manipulated, you know, and we hear the political rhetoric of, you know, well, be Christian means to be against this or that. Well, some of us who are Christians saying, no, it's much bigger than just being against this or that or whatever. And so it seems as though this particular time is a kairotic kind of moment for us to say, what does it mean for us to speak theologically to what is occurring in our day? Because that certainly is what Luther did in lots and lots of writings, some of which we might want to say, yes, that was at the core of what he was about, some of which we say, well, why did he have all this nasty stuff to say about the Jews in his day, and which of course has lived on after him. Now, what I find interesting is that Luther seemed aware of the need to deal with both the objective and the subjective realities of what was holding people in bondage. So rather than primarily mounting a frontal attack on the institutions that were holding people captive, he actually attacked the practices that played into and supported the existing system of domination, which is, I think, what his opposition to indulgences was about.
His propaganda cartoons were really powerful. At this museum that I went to, he showed the examples of what he was saying about the Roman Catholics.
Yep.
And, I mean, it was really crass. You've seen it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Oh, God.
It's
the
nasty.
Pope was a... was the,
Antichrist.
There was a pig wearing the pontiff's hat, wallowing in shit. I mean, it was so crass.
And
it was incredible what he was doing with propaganda, and then having it printed out and dispersed about Europe.
Well, and that also brings in the fact that, you know, if only he had a Pope Francis of his day, because Leonardo Boff wrote one of the articles in our, and basically saying, you know, if in fact Pope Francis had been that day, there'd be no Reformation, because Pope Francis is in many ways the real reformer in our day.
That's right.
Especially the way in which he reaches across the U.S.-Mexico border and you know, does all kinds, you know, his use of ritual and of symbols is powerful and is really speaking to common ordinary folks. And that's why, I mean, you know, clearly when I talk about Luther's, the power of domination he was attacking then was the reigning church, you know, and all the economic and political connections with that. Yeah, much more powerful institution than we think of today. And clearly doesn't mean being anti-Catholic today. But if anything, I mean, I think one of the more meaningful events of the last year was the way in which Pope Francis appeared in Lund, Sweden, with the you know, representatives of the Lutheran World Federation, and saying, no, now we, you know, even the history of that event has to be reconsidered. And there's a book from Conflict to Communion that has been developed by the Catholic Church and by the Lutherans, which basically says, can we have a common reading of that history? Because you're right, I mean, the way in which Lutherans said terrible things about Catholics and the Pope, I mean, some of his, I've been told recently that the German language is quite different because of a lot of the language that Luther used, some of which was nice language, not nice language, and you know, and so I think, yeah, it's, and that's part of what I'm saying. I think it's important for us to say that part connected with this was the way in which Luther was able to see what was holding people in bondage. That was not just a spiritual bondage, but how that was reinforced by all these other kinds of powers. This is what I had, is another, this is expanding in that. For Luther, the subjective eternal reality of God's justification or salvation has external objective consequences. Both theology and economy were at stake, which is why Luther attacked both indulgences and the practice of usury. In other words, the practice of taking advantage of those who are especially vulnerable. If justification remains confined to a spiritual realm apart from societal implications, then injustices will continue to have free reign, distorting our most basic relationship to God, ourselves, and one another. This is not to imply that the world can be governed by the gospel, but what is unleashed is a power that cannot remain quiet or passive in the face of unjust systems because of how they themselves distort how human beings are viewed and hold people in captivity, both spiritually and materially. And in this sense, justification and justice are very closely connected. And I think part of what's holding people in captivity, and we'll reflect on this tomorrow, is the way in which false promises, and people say, oh yes, if you know, you only believe this, and the illusions that are perpetuated, and the compromising of what is truth. You know, truth is, well, whatever I believe. And so, you know, there's lots of ways in which that's occurring in our day. But I want to, in addition to this, also bring up something else. This is, as I told Carol, this is the only day I will do all of these, let's see.
Escape.
Yes. And then I can get into this one. I said previously that I was in Germany at the very beginning of January because this whole project culminated with a gathering in Wittenberg. And this included people from around the world. I mean, I would say probably the largest number were Europeans. There were a few of us Americans there. But people from Asia and Latin America and a few from Africa. And there's copies here of the declaration that we're calling the the Wittenberg Declaration. It's not here. And there's five parts of the Declaration. I won't go into all of that right here. And I think it's significant that this gathering also included Muslims and Jews, you know, or at least theologians in those traditions. So it wasn't, it certainly wasn't just Lutherans. I mean, the whole project has involved a lot of other people from different traditions, Mennonite, certainly Reformed, Anglican or Episcopalian participants, and quite a number have signed on to the documents, the theses that were developed previously. So you can see what some of the sections of this deal with. Ecumenical consensus to reject the increasingly totalitarian, multi-dimensional capitalist culture. And here the idea is not just the economic, but the way in which you are what you make of yourselves, and everything becomes measured in monetary kinds of terms. The struggle of small farmers and peasants worldwide by rejecting agribusiness and land grabbing, and by supporting life-enhancing agricultural instead. It's very interesting that one of the Brazilian theologians there, she was describing what happens, what is currently happening with the peasants in Latin America. And basically, you know, it's like the peasants' war is not just something that happened 500 years ago, but as she said, the peasants' war continues. We may not call any peasants here in the U.S., but they do in Latin America. And then a third part is really on justice for Palestinians and Israelis through interreligious solidarity. I know that some of you have recently been in the Holy Land, but I think it's, and here especially, in Germany, there's a real drive to denounce some of the way in which Zionism gets used as a political agenda for Israel. And of course, given Germany's history, they've been more reluctant to denounce or, you know, to denounce and to be as pro-Palestinian as for example, some movements in this country are. Fourth, rejecting all military, sexual, racist, structural, and cultural violence. And then fifth, and this is the part I worked on, develop participatory institutions and practices in faith communities, society, and politics on the basis that no human being is illegal, but created in the image of God. And then the end of the fifth section. We urge that in congregations and other settings, critical Bible studies engage the urgent systemic challenges in their context and globally. Encourage people to think critically about the systems dominating their lives and empower them for individual and collective resistance and transformation of these challenges for the sake of greater dignity and justice for all. So that's another, you know, if any of you want to, I think there's 8 or 10 copies of both the congregational study as well as the justice alone kind of thing. Those of you who are Lutherans or have studied some Lutheran theology are aware that Lutherans talk a lot about the sola scriptura, sola Christus, in other words, and this group said, in addition to that, it should be justice too, you know, for many of the people around the world. So it isn't to displace those other solas, but to add to them what needs to be added to. So if any of you are interested in the,
It was kind of a short reach there.
Right. The website where you can still find some of the stuff is called Radicalizing Reformation. .com.
Radicalizing-reformation.
Yeah, dash. Mm-hmm. Reformation.com. I will also put up my there's no dot there. Because I can send you any of these documents electronically.
Gmail.com, yeah.
Let's see if there's something else I want to put up there. I think that's enough for now. And are there other questions or reactions that any of you have before we leave for dinner?
Is there an economic system you're advocating beyond capitalism?
No, I would say no. I think we're, how do we get beyond the kind of division, that has been capitalism and socialism, etc. I think we're now in an era where how we think of ways in which economic activity, and I think Holden has been a good place where, how can we think differently about things economic? But no, it isn't a matter of, because certainly some of the state-driven socialism is not a model either.
No, I fully accept that capitalism unchecked has been pretty vile. But it comes in second to what socialism unchecked has done. So there's something that doesn't work in human economic systems, but I'm not aware of one that doesn't oppress or rely on greed. Those seem to be the drivers of the two principal economic systems.
Yeah, I was kind of stuck on number one. Could you go down, can you scroll down?
This one?
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. Capitalism is the system that we've got, and it's not working particularly well in some places and sometimes. But on the other hand, the replacement of it, I can't imagine what that would be.
Well, and again, here the critique is more the way in which that way of measuring everything by profit and by, how much we value something by price, and how that even I think carries over into the church, and how that kind of way of operating just permeates the whole.
Karen, just came to mind, recent thing I read just this weekend, the weekend. American Airlines came out the day before their union's contracts are up, promising a raise to the pilots and flight attendants. Wall Street reacted very negatively because it was going to impact the bottom line, as opposed to thinking of what this was doing for the people. And actually, in this commentator writing on it, was going to be better for the company because it was going to reduce turnover and training and other costs, right, which would otherwise also reduce the bottom line. But initially, when they announced it, the reaction was, labor costs going up, that means profits will be down.
Mm-hmm. I think there's an operative word that we get trapped by, and that's system. I run a city, and I'm trying to improve the quality of life for the people that are employed by that city. And systems don't do that. Systems look for bottom lines. Mm-hmm. Systems look to maximize profit. And systems are mindless, they're soulless, they're numbers driven, And actually, the business world took a little turn away from that about 25 years ago and looked more towards the management side as opposed to the MBA side, because it focused on leadership versus bottom line. But the more I deal with things, I find that there isn't a system that works. There are people, people of faith, people of conscience, people of conviction, that when able to express leadership with conscience, where they have influence, they make conditions better. But systems left to their, a system by design tries to maximize something. A society that maximizes human potential and human capital is not a system that maximizes measurables, whether it's profit or efficiency. I would say socialism looks for equilibrium, whereas capitalism looks for maximized profit. It's actually the opposite of an equilibrium-based system. And in neither side is human capital the measurement that we maximize.
Right.
In any system, it can be functional if led by men and women who value humans over raw numbers or other types of measurements. And that's frustrating, because all large organizations, governments, corporations, want to be able to measure things, make them something you can write down and specify, when in fact I think it's individual leadership,
yeah,
and conviction and commitment that give us the society we're looking for.
And in fact, they ask you to set goals to do that. You know, what is it we're all about? What is it we're trying to do? We want to maximize this, we want to maximize that.
Yeah, and
unless you think in terms of like quality of life of the employees or quality of life of the constituents or whomever it is, then...
Well, in my city, I have goals, objectives, and I have core values. And I'm looking, in my city, we look for quality of life. We look for respect. We look for stewardship. Whether that's stewardship of public funds, stewardship of the environmental resources within our community, or stewardship of the historical aspects of our culture that exist within our city. And so we've tried to place those above other measures and balance those. And finding balance, and giving it's hard to write it down and create something it's that you can just give to somebody and say, do this. It has to come from your soul, not from a bottom line.
Well, a $15 an hour minimum wage is a very popular idea among some, but and we know that people can't make a living on $7.50 an hour. They cannot. And I'm not sure people can make a living on $15 an hour. If they're a single parent trying to make a living raising a family, I'm not sure they can make it on $15 an hour. We all know that, and yet the idea or the notion that we're actually going to legislate a $15 an hour minimum wage, I don't see that happening. I don't think that's coming anywhere soon, because it's against the bottom line.
It is, but I think there's a bigger structural issue than just that. I don't think we turn jobs that really shouldn't be careers, really should not be professions. They ought to be for the high school student working part-time, wanting to save some money for college, and they are not a provider for family for that. The bigger structural issue is, in the last 50 years, the Western world has shipped an entire segment of its economy to the non-developed world. And so then this entire range of jobs, good jobs that provide a living wage, are gone. You can't turn jobs that don't provide enough value to make them survive. You can't just bankrupt everybody to do that. And so we have a structural issue in what we have done for the sake of the bottom line. Mm-hmm. You know, we've shipped all of our manufacturing away. We got to find a way to recover that, to recapitalize. And instead of trying to take the bottom and make it something it's not, you know, we shouldn't have heads of households working as fast food workers.
Right.
That's not where we want them to be.
But that's where we're at.
That's because what they should be doing is gone. So, as opposed to putting a Band-Aid on that and dealing with a symptom, we've got to go back to what the root cause is and fix that structural issue.
Okay, I think our time is up, thank you. Beginning of good discussion, we can continue tomorrow, but tomorrow, just to repeat, that we, especially, how do we think about the theologically about the whole of the, what we're facing today? So I think it will be a good continuation of what we started today. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Bon appetit.